I'm not saying that you and I will ever be perfect. We won't be perfect. But we ought to have a willing heart. We ought to willingly go to God on a daily basis. We ought to willingly go to God each day and say, I want your Spirit to control my life this day. I want to be obedient to you. And as much as I understand your will for my life, I will be obedient. Not stopping a day short of obedience. That's what Jacob did. Because he made that choice, he brought tragedy into his family. Because he made the choice to stop short of obedience to God, short of full obedience to God, he brought a tragedy into his family that we began to study last year through the violation of his daughter Dinah. That choice in his life placed them right outside the city of Shechem. It placed them right in conjunction with the people of the land. People from whom Israel was to be separate. We're going to spend a lot of time next week from Genesis 35 talking about that separation that you and I are to have from the world. Now, you see, we can't go out of the world. But the Scripture's clear. We are to be in the world, but not what? Of the world. Of the world. We'll talk a lot about that next week. But Jacob made a tragic choice. And it seems that it was informed by the promise of commerce, the promise of trade, the promise of more wealth. Whatever the reason, he stopped a day short of obedience, and that choice led to a tragic consequence in his family's life. Not only did it overwhelm Dinah as she is violated, but it overwhelmed her brothers who carry out a murderous response to what happened to her. Now, don't misunderstand me. We will talk about this as we go. They surely should have responded somehow. Jacob should have responded somehow. His family should have responded somehow to the violation of his daughter, their sister. But the response is way out of range. Jacob made a choice. Now, we talked about that last week. We talked about the fact that Dinah went down, chapter 34. If you look with me at chapter 34, verse 1 says, "Now Dinah, the daughter Leah had born to Jacob, went out to visit the women of the land." You'll remember from last week that apparently a lot more is going on here than we see in the text. According to the Jewish historian Josephus, she actually went into Shechem not just to visit with the ladies, but she went in to participate in a heathen pagan festival. It placed her at the wrong place, at the wrong time, with the wrong people. Now, last week I spent the whole time talking about that, the fact that we have got to be careful about the choices we make. We have got to be careful to be not in the wrong place, at the wrong time, with the wrong people. Now, two things happened this past week. I challenged you last week, if you remember. I don't know if anybody took the challenge, but to take about the next month and in the paper and in the news, just to write down. Remember, one of the maxims that Kathy and I shared with our sons all through their growing up years. I'm not saying they always listened to us. Was nothing good happens between midnight and 6 a.m. Right? Now, all I'm trying to say is I believe they are extremely dangerous hours for people. For young people, for adults, they are extremely dangerous hours. Maybe you saw this just the other day about the teenager who was killed playing Russian roulette in San Antonio. How many of you saw that? One. Okay? Let me read from the article. "A teenager playing Russian roulette with a handgun was killed Friday after shooting himself in the head," authorities said. The young man pointed the gun toward the right side of his head and pulled the trigger as he talked about the deadly game with others, according to a San Antonio police report. And according to the TV report, supposedly he thought they were kidding, that there was a round in the gun. Okay? There was one, and he killed himself. Listen to this. "The shooting occurred shortly before 3 a.m. Friday. Witnesses told police the gentleman grabbed the gun from someone else and began talking about Russian roulette. The victim was just 1 week shy of his 19th birthday. What a tragedy. Again, my theorem is this. Nothing good happens between midnight and 6 a.m. All right? They're dangerous hours. So I challenge you to continue looking. Talking about choices, let me just throw this out. It's been all over the news last week about the Craigslist killer. How many of you have heard of the Craigslist killer? Okay, a lot more of you have heard. This guy, and everybody is stunned by this, because this gentleman charged with a crime, I know he's innocent until proven guilty, they found a lot of incriminating evidence at his apartment, but nonetheless everybody's stunned because this guy was a clean-cut second-year medical student who you would never look at and say, there beside me is walking a murderer. But as they tried to uncover what would be behind this, what would cause him to be wrapped up in this sort of thing, to get himself caught up in this sort of thing, and what they are uncovering is he had gambling debts. He began to gamble and couldn't control his gambling. At least that's the last report I heard. They may learn more. But he couldn't control the gambling. The gambling caused him to rob what he thought was the most vulnerable people, which were young women engaged in risky activity. That's all I'll say about that. And so he would make these liaisons, rob them, and feed his gambling habit. Now, this is what one psychologist said. Even though he doesn't fit the profile of a killer, he's a clean-cut medical student who was engaged to be married this summer, looks can be deceiving. So much of crime is about choices, this psychologist said. This is a situation of someone who had everything to lose, and his choices imploded his life. His choices imploded his life. I can't express deeply enough how important the choices we make are. Even those choices that seem innocuous at the time, even those choices that seem like, oh, it's just a throwaway choice. You and I have to be careful about the choices we make, about where we're going, who we're going with, and when we're going. We have got to be careful. They can lead us on paths we never thought we'd go. I thought about this young man. I don't know about you, but when I hear things like this, I just can't help but try to put my mind into what's going on there. And I thought about this guy, 22 years old, second year medical student, and now look what he's facing, a life of. Look what he got involved with. And I'll bet you if he had sat in a church like this when he was 14 years old, he would have said nothing like that could ever happen in my life. And now at 22, he faces what he does. Choices, they make a difference. All right, Jacob made a choice. He made a choice that negatively impacted his family. Why he made that choice, we don't know. We can speculate. We can speculate, as Dr. Kidner did, that part of it is because this was a good place for commerce and Bethel wouldn't have been such a good place to be. And Jacob thought, I can live here. After all, it is in the promised land. After all, I'm within a day of obedience to God. How many of us have thought like that? I'm almost completely obedient. And he made a choice that so negatively impacted his family. Now we're going to look, we're going to go through chapter 34, we're going to see lessons on two levels, and I want you to understand this. We're going to see lessons to the nation of Israel. Remember what's being recorded here, the narratives of the Old Testament were meant to teach Israel something later on. They were meant to illustrate for Israel truths that they should be living by. And so we're going to be looking at some of what happens in chapter 34 from a national point of view for the people of God, Israel, and for us, the people of God. And then we're going to also look at this from a familial or family point of view. You see, both points of view are here, and we're going to try to make application as we go. In fact, one writer said this, while the story operates at a level of family honor and brotherly concern for a ravished sister, it nevertheless also carries along the themes that God works through and often in spite of the limited self-serving plans of human beings. Now, it's interesting. Despite the horrific nature of chapter 34, all around what happened to Dinah, what happens to the people of Shechem, what Reuben and Levi did, what Jacob didn't do. Despite all of that, the bottom line is God accomplishes His purposes. God accomplishes His purposes. And what God does, and we've seen this before in the book of Genesis, is God takes the stuff available to Him. God takes the stuff available. What do I mean by the stuff? You and me. He takes the stuff available to Him, the sinful stuff available to Him, the incomplete obedience stuff available to Him, and He still will accomplish His purpose. I tell you what, I can't wait to get to heaven to understand how all this works out. But God's a glorious God, and He works out His will, even in spite of the people He has to work through. Now, we're going to see a lot of planning and scheming in chapter 34. We thought we were done with that. We thought maybe Jacob was done with planning and scheming. But here's what I want you to see is interesting. Remember, Jacob did a lot of planning and scheming in his life rather than living by faith. And we've seen him progress. We've seen him grow. We've seen God deal with his life. The interesting thing about chapter 34 is there is planning and there is scheming, but it's not done by Jacob. At least not overtly. Do you know who the planning and scheming is done by in chapter 34? Come on, think about it. You guys are good students. Come on, you can do what you do in life. You can figure this out. There's planning and scheming in chapter 4. It's not overtly done by Jacob. Who's it done by? His sons. His sons. In fact, we're going to learn that his sons will be the fourth generation of deceivers in that family. The fourth generation of deceivers in that family. Dr. Warren Wiersbe said this, it was another case of promoting a holy cause in an unholy way. Well, that's sort of an overview of chapter 34. Let's dive in with the time we have. Dinah, you know, daughter of Leah, born to Jacob, went out to visit the women of the land, apparently, according to Josephus, to this pagan religious festival. When Shechem, son of Hamar the Hivite, the ruler of the area, saw her, he took her and violated her. His heart was drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. And I'm thinking to myself as I read this, wow, what a way to show it. What a way to show how he loved her, okay? And Shechem said to his father, Hamar, get me this girl as my wife. Now, again, Hebrew scholars, looking at the verb forms in this passage, are all over the board. It's unclear if this was an actual rape or if this was fornication. It's not clear, but the clear thing about this is in some way Dinah was violated and it was wrong. In some way Dinah was violated in this passage and it was wrong. Now, verse 5. Verse 5 absolutely blows me away. Now I want you to think, before you look at verse 5, look up at me. I want you to think about this. Your daughter has been violated by someone. What do you think your response is going to be? Some anger? More than anger? Yeah, violent, exactly. That's what I think my response would be. I think my response would be, he did what? And I'd be up off my seat and on my way to have a visit with him. Tell you what, I'm a fairly mild-mannered person. At least I think I am. I don't know. You can decide. I think I'm a fairly easygoing person. But if you want to see my fierce side, you do something to my wife or family. you will see my fierce side like you never believed could be there. And that's why I don't understand verse 5. When Jacob heard that his daughter Dinah had been defiled, his sons were in the fields with his livestock, so he kept quiet about it until they came home. He has sat there. He sat there doing nothing. There is no seeking after God. There is no righteous anger. There is nothing. He sat on his backside waiting for his sons to come in from the fields. That seems like an odd response to me. I don't understand it. Now, by the way, the response of Simeon and Levi later is overkill, literally. But this required some response on the part of Jacob, and apparently there is no response on the part of Jacob. Now, one writer suggested this, that there was more concern for peace than for honor with Jacob. That's a quote. There was more concern for peace than for honor with Jacob. That he was more concerned about upsetting the peaceful interrelationship he had with the people of Shechem, the people of the land, the people with whom he was not to have social interaction, and especially not religious interaction, but it is possible that he was more concerned for peace than for honor. Others, less kind than that, believe that he was more concerned for the possibilities of commerce that would be wrecked by this and that would be promoted by the suggestion that Shechem and his father Hamor make to the Israelites in verses 9 and 10 and 12. And we'll get to that in just a moment. What was the reason? Was he more concerned for peace? Was he more concerned for the possibility of commerce? When we come to the closing verses of this chapter, verses 30 and 31, it seems that he is more concerned for the repercussions that might come to his life than he was concerned about the sin of his sons or the sin of Shechem. I don't know what the reason for this response is, but he seems to be at this point, and this is where we're going to see a little bit of this family level here. He seems to be a disengaged father. A disengaged father. At least in this situation, he doesn't seem to be engaged in it at all. In fact, he never becomes engaged in the situation. As it goes on, it's his sons who take the lead, not him. He seems to be disengaged from his family, especially from Dinah. When you have a disengaged father, whatever the reason he's disengaged, perhaps it was favoritism for the children of Rachel versus the children of Leah. Perhaps he was focused on commerce or business or work or his profession. Whatever the reason, he seems to be disengaged from his children. And I tell you, that is to me a red flag for you and I who are fathers. A warning not to be disengaged from our family, not to be disengaged from our children. It is so easy. Men find their self-worth in their occupation. And so it is so easy for a man to disengage from his family in pursuit of his profession. To disengage from his family in pursuit of commerce or business or whatever it may be. If you have children, if you are looking forward to having children at some point in your life, you had better mark it down that you and I have got to be engaged with them. We have got to be engaged fathers. We could say so much more about that, and we have over past weeks about how important that is. But I want you to see a second thing. A disengaged father in this passage leads to out of control children. where a father is not engaged with his family, where a father is not engaged with his children, you will see out of control children. And that's exactly what we're going to see in this passage. Now, let's move on to passage. Then Shechem, verse 6. Shechem's father Hamor went out to talk with Jacob. Now Jacob's sons had come in from the fields as soon as they heard what had happened. They were filled with grief and fury. Now that seems a little closer to what you should feel. To be filled with grief over what has happened to your sister. This would severely be a problem, especially in that day, for her future. For the ability to contract a good marriage for her. And they were filled with grief. And on the other side of the coin, they were filled with fury over what had been done. Jacob doesn't seem to feel any of the grief or fury. So his sons come in. They're full of grief and fury because of Shechem, that he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing that should not be done. But Hamor said to them, now this is how Hamor, Shechem's father, by the way, the city of Shechem was probably named after this man, Shechem. His father, Hamor, makes a proposal. Now, by the way, the sons of Jacob aren't the only devious ones in this passage. This man, Hamor, is devious himself, and we'll see that in a few moments. Hamor said to them, my son Shechem has his heart set on your daughter. Please give her to him as his wife. Intermarry with us. And you know what? Any future Israelite hearing those words ought to have brakes going off in their head. Intermarry with Canaanites? Intermarry with the people of the land? Isn't that exactly what Abraham was afraid of when he sent Eleazar to find a bride for Isaac? Isn't that exactly what he said? Do not let my son Isaac marry a Canaanite. Do not let him intermarry with the people of the land. Isn't that exactly what the concern of, apart from Esau's threat to kill Jacob, but isn't that also the concern of Isaac to send, and Rebekah, to send Jacob to Haran to find a bride, warning him, do not intermarry with the people of the land. You see Hamor's proposal here? Intermarry with us. We'll have more to say about that in just a moment. Intermarry with us and take our daughters for yourselves. You can settle among us. The land is open to you. Now listen to this. Listen to this. Live in it. Trade in it. And acquire property in it. Was this not the land God promised to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob? Was this not the promised land? They didn't need for the Canaanites to give it to them. God had promised it to them. But you see, they're saying, intermarry with us, trade with us, live in the land, acquire property in it. Then Shechem said to Dinah's father and brothers, let me find favor in your eyes and I will give you whatever you ask. Make the price for the bride and the gift I am to bring as great as you like and I'll pay whatever you ask me. Only give me the girl as my wife. Two times later in this passage, verse 16 and verse 22, we read the phrase, we will be one people. We will be one people. Now here is where we see an application to the nation of Israel. Here's where we see an application to the people of Israel. One of the keys to understanding this whole passage is to understand the intent that Israel should not intermarry with the people of the land. Israel should not have social interaction and particularly religious interaction with the people of the land. Remember later in the book of Joshua when the Israelites take the land of Canaan, when God delivers it to them. In many cases, God's instruction to the Israelites was to wipe out everybody. Why did he do that? Because he's a mean God? The reason God instructed that is because any of the people, any of the Canaanites left in the land would do what to the people of Israel? They would drag them down. They would drag them into their false religion. They would drag them into idolatry. By the way, if you think that that's a false premise, just read the book of Judges. Over and over again, the cycle in the book of Judges is that Israel went to the people of the land. Israel partook of idolatry. Israel then was oppressed by the people of the land. God raised up a deliverer. Israel's delivered. They live for a while in the pure state, and then it starts all over again. It's a cycle that goes on and on and on. You see, the Canaanites revile people. They revile people. One of the vilest things they did as part of their religion, they sacrificed their own children to their gods. I've shared with you before that one of the images that I just can't seem to get out of my own mind is that as I read of some of the Canaanite false religion and false worship, they had these false idols and they would build these metal idols with their arms extended and they would heat them till they were molten hot, and then they would take their babies and lay them into those arms, sacrificing them to the false gods. That's why God said to Israel, wipe them all out. You see, the stench of their sin was so great. Well, here we have the people of Canaan. Here we have Hamar, the Hivites, saying, just be part of us. Come intermarry with us. Come do business with us. Come buy land with us. Now, by the way, he has an ulterior motive you're going to see in just a few moments. But On a warning to Israel, this passage, this whole passage is a warning to Israel about relationships with the people of the land, about not intermarrying with the people of the land, about not giving their daughters to the people of the land. They were to be separate. They were to be separate. And the people of God in every generation are to be separate. We'll talk more about that next week. In the New Testament, I've mentioned this before, and we've talked about it many times, about Paul's injunction to the Corinthians when he said, do not be unequally yoked together. Now, I've talked a lot about it in the past, so I just want to spend just a little bit, just by way of reminder, particularly if you're new here, the Scripture is clear that we are not to be intimately involved with non-believers. By intimately involved, I mean closely, for instance, in a business relationship. I mean intimately involved, for instance, closely in a marriage relationship that, by the way, always begins with a dating relationship. How many people have said, well, you know what, I'm not going to marry that person. You know, parents will say to their son or daughter, we have tried to teach you what the Scripture says. Don't date unbelievers. And what's the first thing they say? I'm not going to marry him. By the way, marrying an unbeliever starts with, guess what? Dating. Now, let me share something real quickly. I love J. Vernon McGee. I've told you that many times. And he has such a plain way of speaking. He shared this. Let me share this. It's talking about this intermarriage, marrying the intimate relationship between a believer and a non-believer. He says this: this ought to be a warning today to a great many people. I recall one couple who came to me for counseling and asked me to perform their marriage ceremony. I would not unite them in marriage because he was not a Christian, and she claimed that she would not marry him unless he became a Christian. I talked with him, and he said he would accept Christ. How convenient. All right? We had prayer, and then I asked him, what have you really done? I have never heard such hemming and hawing and beating around the bush as this boy did. Very frankly, I said right in front of him, young lady, I'll not perform the ceremony. I don't think the young man is converted. They felt that I was being very harsh, and they went down the street and got another preacher to perform the ceremony. After they were married, she tried to get him to go to church. Of course, he had a good reason for not coming to hear me preach, because I'd been cruel to him. But then she agreed to go to another church, and they went two or three times, and finally he just said to her point blank, really, I'm not a Christian. See, people will say a lot of things in the heat of a relationship, especially when they want to marry that person. They will say anything. This passage is a warning to Israel. A warning to Israel about the dangers of social interaction with the people of the land, religious interaction with the people of the land, intermarrying with the people of the land. Well, verse 13. Because their sister Dinah had been defiled, Jacob's sons replied deceitfully. Now we have some deceit on their part. You're going to see in a moment the deceit on Hamar's part. But now we see the deceit of Dinah's brothers. They said to them, "We can't do such a thing. We can't give our sister to a man who's not circumcised. That would be a disgrace to us. We will give our consent to you on one condition only, that you become like us by circumcising all your males. Then we will give you our daughters and take your daughters for ourselves. We'll settle among you and become one people with you. But if you will not agree to be circumcised, we'll take our sister and go." Well, they have an ulterior motive, you'll see in just a moment. Their proposal seemed good to Hamar and his son Shechem. The young man, who was the most honored of all his father's household, lost no time in doing what they said, because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. So Hamar and his son Shechem went to the gate of their city. That's where commerce went on. That's where the judge sat. That's where interaction of the city went on. They went to the gate of the city to speak to their fellow townsmen. "These men are friendly toward us," they say. "Let them live in our land and trade in it. The land has plenty of room for them. We can marry their daughters. They can marry our son. They can marry ours. But the men will consent to live with us as one people only on one condition, that our males be circumcised as they themselves are." Now, verse 23 shows us the deceit on the part of Hamar and Shechem. "Won't their livestock, their property, and all their other animals become ours? So let us give our consent to them, and they will settle among us." Do you see what's going on here? What's going on here is it is a backdoor way to get to Jacob's wealth. It's a backdoor way to get all that Jacob owns and make it become part of the people of the city of Shechem. Well, I can hardly believe what comes next, but verse 24, "All the men who went out of the city gate agreed with Hamar and his son Shechem, and every male in the city was circumcised." That made for a lot of painful surgeries, okay? And a lot of painful recoveries, which leads to what happened next. 3 days later, while all of them were still in pain, two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers — by the way, the only other older brother she had was, or the firstborn brother was Reuben, and then the nextborn were Simeon and Levi, they were her older brothers — took their swords and attacked the unsuspecting city, killing every male. Now, by the way, a response to the violation of their sister was warranted, but this response was not. A response to their sister being violated was warranted, but not what they did. And it didn't stop at killing them. They put Hamar and his son Shechem to the sword. They took Dinah from Shechem's house and left. The sons of Jacob came upon the dead bodies and looted the city where their sister had been defiled. So they didn't stop at killing them. Then they looted the city. They seized their flocks. Now, by the way, it's unclear in the text whether it was just Simeon and Levi who did the whole thing, or many believe Simeon and Levi did the killing. The other brothers said, "Hey, it's a good time to get a little more wealth here." Okay? At any rate, they seized their flocks and herds and donkeys and everything else of theirs in the city and out in the fields. They carried off all their wealth and all their women and children, taking as plunder everything in the houses. Now, I want you to see once again Jacob's response. Now, we're going to talk a moment about what the Simeon and Reuben did. Simeon and Levi did. We're going to talk in a moment about that and about why that was literally overkill. But first, let's finish the passage, verses 30 and 31. "Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me a stench to the Canaanites and Perizzites, the people living in this land. We are few in number, and if they join forces against me and attack me, I and my household will be destroyed." Now, again, I find that a strange response in the way from Jacob. He seems to be more concerned about repercussions than he is about the sin of his sons or the sin of Shechem. He's more concerned about the repercussions than he is about the sin that was done to his daughter or the sin that his sons committed on the people of Shechem. He's more concerned with the way people respond to him than he is concerned about standing for truth. Now, I find in that an application to you and an application to me. How many times are we more concerned about how people respond to us than we are about standing for the truth? How many times do we keep our mouths shut about our relationship with Jesus Christ because it might interfere with our chance for advancement? Or because it might cause somebody to think we're weird. Jacob was concerned about the repercussions more than he was concerned about sin, more than he was concerned about truth. How many times are we more concerned about repercussions in our lives? How many times are we more concerned about that than we are about standing for the truth? Now, by the way, I want to have a caveat here. Whenever you and I share our faith, whenever we share our faith, we should never be offensive about it, okay? Now, that doesn't mean people won't be offended, but it should not be because we're offensive people or offensive in our presentation of the gospel. What do I mean by that? You see, Paul said that we are the smell of death to those who are dying. When you and I walk past unbelievers on our job, in our school, wherever it may be, we smell like death to them. It's not because we didn't use the right cologne that morning. Why? We smell like death to them because we are a witness that they are dying, and no one likes to be reminded that they're dying and going to a Christless eternity. And so we are the smell of death to those who are dying. Because we stand before them with the truth of the gospel. Now, a second thing Paul said. Paul said that the cross is an offense. What does he mean by that? He means particularly, he's talking to the Corinthians, and he's talking about how to the Greeks, the very thought that you could be saved eternally by one who died on a cross was offensive to them. I've got philosophy. I've got intelligence. I've got truth. How many unbelievers say that today? And all you got is a guy on a cross? Paul said the cross is an offense. It's an offense. So when we share the truth of the gospel, when we share the truth of the cross, people may be offended. But if they're offended, it should be because they're offended at the cross, not at our presentation. So I think we need to think through how we stand up for our faith, how we say what we say. But it seems Jacob was more concerned, again, for the repercussions than he was for the sin done to his daughter, the sin that his sons did to the city of Shechem. Verse 31 is an interesting reply. It shuts Jacob up. The sons replied, "Should he have treated our daughter, our sister, like a prostitute?" Obviously not. Obviously not. Now, we've seen the application of this on a national level. I want to make two applications to us real quickly, and we're closing, okay? Two applications to us. Number one, when we are wronged, I want you to write down a passage of Scripture, and I'm going to beg you not to open your Bibles to it. Okay? I want you to write it down so you can look it up later. When we are wronged, the guidance for you and the guidance for me and how to respond to that wrong is found in Romans chapter 12, verses 19 to 21. Romans chapter 12, verses 19 to 21, tells us how we are to respond to being wronged. All right? And basically what Paul says in that passage is that we are not to take vengeance into our own hands, but we are rather to understand that vengeance belongs to God, and we must leave any vengeance, any revenge in the hands of God. So when we're wronged, we must not exact revenge. By the way, revenge never evens the score. Do you understand that? Have you seen that in your own life? You can never even the score with revenge, because revenge almost always goes way overboard and just makes a wider problem. When we are wronged on the negative side, we must not exact revenge. On the positive side, we must by faith leave it to God to straighten out. He'll do it. He'll straighten out the situation. Now, He won't do it in your timetable or my timetable, but God will straighten out the situation. And we have got to do the right thing. We have got to live rightly. As Paul said, as much as lies within you, live at peace with all people. In other words, there may be times when people won't allow you to live at peace, but as much as you and I have anything to do about it, we've got to live at peace with other people. By the way, now here's where a lot of times you're familiar with the lex talionis. That's the law of the eye for an eye, the tooth for the tooth, the life for a life. You're familiar with that? It drives me crazy when I hear people, especially people on programs who know nothing about the Bible, cast that out. Oh, don't forget, we're not living under eye for eye, tooth for tooth. As if it is somehow a invitation to violence. Do you understand that the lex talionis was not an invitation to violence? What it was a limitation of violence. You see, because what it said was, if somebody takes your eye out, what is your proper response? Not go beyond taking their eye out. And that's the eye for the eye. In other words, you don't take a life for an eye. If somebody knocks your tooth out, the proper response is to not go beyond a tooth. You don't take out their whole mouth, okay? You don't break their arm. You don't break their legs. You don't go beyond. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. It was meant not to promote violence. It was meant to limit the response. But we don't live under that. We live under, and I want you to be clear on this, we live under Romans 12, 19 to 21, leaving vengeance to God, not taking it in our own hands. When you're wrong, you must not exact revenge. You must leave it by faith in God's hands. Last thing I want to talk about, just spend a couple more minutes on, is this. I've mentioned that Jacob's sons were the fourth generation of deceit. Abraham's the first. If you don't remember, look back at Genesis 11 and 12. Abraham's the first. He lied about his wife in Egypt. Isaac's the second. He lied about his wife to Abimelech. Jacob's the third. He lived a whole life of deceit. And now we see that the infection of deceit has infected his sons. So the question for us, again, moms and dads, is what legacy are we leaving our children? What will future generations of our children be like because of what you and I do today, what we believe today, what we live today? This is the fourth generation of deceit. I like what Woodrow Wilson, when he was president of Princeton University, said to a parents group. By the way, I can't imagine any college or university administrator today being this open with parents. Woodrow Wilson said this: I get many letters from you parents about your children. You want to know why we people up here in Princeton, by the way, he was president of the I don't know if I said that. You want to know why we people up here in Princeton can't make more out of them and do more for them. Let me tell you the reason we can't. It may shock you just a little bit, but I'm not trying to be rude. The reason is that they are your sons. reared in your homes, blood of your blood, bone of your bones. They have absorbed the ideals of your homes. You have formed and fashioned them. They are your sons. In those malleable, moldable years of their lives, you have forever left your imprint upon them. In other words, why can't we do more with your sons? Because of what you did with them when they were growing up in your home. See, because of the way we live, the way we believe, the things we do, what our future generations of our family is going to be like. Let me give you an example, one that you've heard many times before. I'm going to close with this. Consider the lives of two men lived some 200 plus years ago, okay? One of them, Max Jukes, lived, I'm sure many of you have heard this, lived in New York. He did not believe in Christ or give Christian training to his children. He refused to take his children to church even when they asked to attend. He had 1,026 descendants, 300 of whom were sent to prison for an average term of 13 years. Some 190 were prostitutes and 680 were admitted alcoholics. His family members cost the state in excess of $500,000 thus far, and they have made no known positive contributions to society. Jonathan Edwards lived in the same state and at the same time. He loved the Lord and saw that his children were in church every Sunday. He served the Lord to the best of his ability. Of his 929 descendants, 430 were ministers, 86 became university professors, 13 became university presidents, 75 wrote positive books, 7 were elected to the U.S. Congress, and 1 served as vice president of the United States. His family never cost the state 1 cent, but contributed immeasurably to the common good. And the quotation that I've been reading to you ends with this question. Ask yourself, and this is where we'll stop today, ask yourself, if my family tree began with me, what fruit might it bear 200 years from now?